What I'm going to talk about today is what I see as a serious problem with the scientific process. Science is normally considered to be the most reliable indicator of truth, and yet on occasion the beliefs generally held by scientists are the opposite of truth. I'm not talking here about simple ignorance, that's cases where the relevant facts haven't been discovered yet, but cases such as telepathy and cold fusion, where facts are available but the scientific community simply refuses to accept them as true. In such cases, it is the very processes of science that are the cause of a problem, in particular the various means whereby discoveries are communicated. Now, communication is the basis of consensus, and while this consensus generally settles upon the truth, the converse is sometimes the case. Now, what do I mean by the truth? Well, I'll define it as what would be the outcome of a rational analysis of all the facts. So, this might go wrong in two ways. Either the subject is not being discussed or dealt with rationally, or because the consensus is based on a partial view of the evidence. Two examples from the past of this pathological disbelief. I've given a lecture on that subject, which you can download from the internet. Two examples are continental drift and Semmelweis's observations that if doctors washed their hands before examining patients, the incidence of childhood fever could be drastically reduced. In the latter case, doctors felt it beneath their dignity to have to wash their hands. The leading obstetrician of the time stated, "Doctors are gentlemen, and gentlemen's hands are clean, so they did not need washing." As a result, these antiseptic procedures were not generally taken up, and many patients died unnecessarily. What is pathological here is principally the fact that while it would not have been very difficult to test Semmelweis's claim, people did not do this. They didn't do it because they didn't believe the claim. They didn't believe the claim because they didn't have an appropriate model. This was before the time of Pasteur and his germs. This tendency to ignore evidence because one cannot think of a mechanism has its modern echo in the words of Steven Weinberg, who said he would not take the time to examine the evidence for telepathy because he could not imagine a mechanism for it. The case of continental drift is similar. Wegener and others had found very clear evidence that the continents had once been joined, but this was rejected by geologists because no physical mechanism allowing for the movement was known. There was also a psychological aspect. Wegener was not a geologist and so had low esteem in the eyes of geologists. But in other cases, such as superconductivity, absence of mechanism does not lead to, or did not lead to, rejection of a phenomenon. It took 40 years before it was understood how superconductivity comes about. In this case, there does not seem to have been strong resistance against the discovery, perhaps because verification is straightforward for any laboratory with access to liquid helium. And the phenomenon itself is unambiguous. Now, if we think about this, we see the following are factors favouring the acceptance of a new claim. First of all, if it is easily reproduced and there's an unambiguous outcome, it's more likely to get accepted. It helps also to be consistent with and ideally explicable on the basis of current theory. And the reputation of the investigator counts as well. So let's look at the cases I've discussed so far. In the case of antiseptic treatments and childbed fever, we have a very big and unambiguous effect. There's an enormous reduction in mortality if doctors wash their hands. On the other hand, if you wanted to confirm this, you'd have to put in a certain amount of effort. And again, there's no applicable theory. The germ theory wasn't around at the time. And the investigator didn't have a particularly high reputation. Again, with continental drift, a certain amount of effort was needed to evaluate the results. There was again no applicable theory, and the investigator did not have a particularly high reputation. Now, if we turn to telepathy, the effects can be fairly big, 33% versus 25% chance outcome for one particular kind of experiment. But individual cases can be explained away as chance. and you need carefully designed experiments with many runs and possibly enhanced by meta-analysis to get definite outcomes. And again, in this case, there's no theoretical explanation. No quantum mechanics is suggested because it has non-locality, but there's no specific model for telepathy. Now, telepathy is a little unusual in compared with the other things I've been talking about, and is in fact a sizable proportion, even of scientists, believe it is a real effect. But they have to avoid making this view known, as it might have detrimental effects on their reputations if people knew somebody believed in that telepathy was real. In this context, a couple of years ago, I was invited to a conference on Bohmian mechanics, and things had progressed as far as my being asked how long I wanted to talk for. And suddenly I got a letter disinviting me on the basis of my interest in parapsychology. It was asserted later by one of the organisers, rather implausibly, that my presence at the meeting might reflect badly on the future prospects of any students there. Here's the letter I received. It has come to my attention that one of your principal research interests is the paranormal. I've told, and he named his co-organiser here, that, in my view, it would not be appropriate for someone with such research interests to attend a scientific conference. On this basis, I have urged him to agree to withdrawing the invitation, much to his personal regret. We are very sorry for any inconvenience caused and wish you a pleasant summer. Well, that demonstrates some of the sociology involved, which I shall return to later. Now, what I want to deal with next is the controversial subject of cold fusion. It's now 23 years since the dramatic announcement in 1989 by Pons and Fleischmann that they had been able to achieve fusion at essentially room temperature using electrolysis. I should say that the fusion we're talking about is two nuclei fusing together into one, as is a source of power for the sun and the hydrogen bomb. This normally requires rather extreme conditions because of the Coulomb barrier that has to be overcome. But Fleischmann had the idea that you could just electrolyze heavy water, and the nuclei being pumped in at the surface of metal, palladium, would concentrate them so much or press them together so much that you would get fusion. And this did in fact seemed to work. So they announced their results, and there was considerable excitement because this might provide a means of fusion energy on a much more practical scale than the high temperature fusion processes in which enormous amounts of money is being spent. But then it all went wrong. People announced that they couldn't replicate it, and so the general belief then was that there was something wrong with the original experiment and there was no fusion process at all. Now, some years later, that I started to realise that that wasn't the actual situation. It happened because somebody gave me a video to look at which described a number of people doing what seemed to be perfectly normal experiments and getting positive results. In some cases, they observed heat being produced in excess of what was being fed into the system. And some people observed nuclear products. So it seemed to be a bit strange. Well, the best thing to do to test a claim is to go along to a lab where the research is being done. And I took the opportunity while I was at a conference in Boston to visit a lab where this work was being done, and this all seemed pretty convincing. The experimenter concerned was getting 30% more heat out of his device than out of a corresponding a similar resistor, and the temperature rise was significant, I think more than 5 degrees centigrade. so there didn't seem to be much one could complain about in this experiment. And over the years, I've visited a few labs where the work is being done. So it seemed that something rather peculiar was happening. If a lot of people are doing these experiments and they work, how is it that the general theory is that this is a kind of delusion? Well, roughly speaking, what happened is that some people tried the experiment and failed, while others tried the experiments and were successful. But the people who were unsuccessful considered this, this showed that there wasn't a real phenomenon at all. And they spoke rather loudly at it. In the next slide, you can see a confrontation between, I think it was Nathan Lewis and Fleischman at a American Physical Society meeting. He's being attacked, and he's being described as having done a poor experiment, or possibly incompetence, possibly fraud. And this had a great deal of influence on public opinion. And what happened was that editors assumed that this wasn't a real effect, and they wouldn't take any papers on the subject. And so it turned out, so the outcome was that they were only published in somewhat obscure journals, and so nobody, well, very few people knew that people were getting successful results. An example of something which influenced the thinking of the physics community is this book by nuclear physicist John Huizenga with the title Cold Fusion, the Fiasco of the Century. The situation seems, however, to be gradually changing. It's sort of something happening behind the scenes. There are people who know that cold fusion is a real phenomenon and they're busy getting on with things. One thing that's happened recently was the death of Martin Fleischman, and I took advantage of this and the opportunity to get some things published. One of the things was this obituary that I sent to the Guardian newspaper. The obituary's editor was initially slightly doubtful because what I sent in wasn't quite obituary material, and he said, well, we're going to be publishing something, so why don't you publish a response? Well, then I think he started thinking about it, and I said to him, do you really want to publish an obituary which is saying things which are untrue, like as many other obituaries said, this is there were great hopes for cold fusion, but it was shown, it was discovered that it was not a real phenomenon. Do you really want to publish something which is saying this, which isn't true? Well, for whatever reason, he changed his mind and said, so do send us in something. Here's what our format is. So I followed the format, and together we worked on the details, and eventually this was published in the newspaper. Well, then another opportunity came along. I was... the journal Nature published an obituary by Philip Ball, which said the usual things, but said them a little more strongly, as he presumably thought he could now do, now that Fleischman was not alive. He talked about pathological science, and talked about people being unable to accept that they're wrong. So I thought, well, here's my chance. I sent in a correspondence, in a letter to Nature correspondence, and this they accepted and published. It's in the issue which where a print version came out today, as the day in which I'm recording this. So hopefully these things will bring to light what had previously been hidden. So what we have here is really an extraordinary situation, some phenomenon which seems to be real. The scientific community, however, thinks it is not real, that it's some kind of delusion, and but the facts just can't get out. There are a couple of occasions when they might have got out. In 2004, the US Department of Energy had an investigation, and the investigation was fairly favourable towards the subject. Quite a number of the panel agreed that there was, there seemed to be a real effect as far as excess heat was concerned anyway. But perhaps the report was a little lukewarm, and anyway, little notice was taken of it. And again, a couple of years ago, there was a program by on CBS TV where Robert Duncan, director of research at the University of Missouri, he was brought in as an expert to evaluate the subjects. And to his surprise, he found there seemed to be good evidence for there being a real effect. And he stated on the program how his views had changed once he'd come to look at it. Again, it had no effect on the scientific community. So if something's seriously wrong, science is not always a self-correcting process. Now, to continue my review, I'd like to talk about two further situations where we seem to have something similar. The first of these is the another controversial subject, memory of water, which owes its origins to the experiments of Jacques Benveniste, an immunologist. This is later followed by people like Nobel laureate Luc Montagnier. Also, Gerald Pollack of University of Washington has done something similar about the properties of water, a fourth state of water, he calls it. Now, Benveniste, was using a technique that he used in his own experiments on immunology. Is a way of detecting biological activity using a process he called basophil degranulation. Someone in his laboratory was interested in homeopathy and said, why don't you use this process to test homeopathic claims? So you would take a biologically active material, such as an anticoagulant, and dilute it very highly in the manner used in homeopathic medicine, and see if the diluted solution had biological activity. Benveniste was quite sceptical, but he found it seemed to work, and he got this result published in Nature, but with certain provisos. The editor of Nature insisted that after publication, the they should carry out their own test to see if they agreed. And this was itself a very funny thing to do, because what's normally done if there's some doubts about the paper is that you do your investigations before publication, because you naturally don't want a wrong result to appear in the literature. But it is said that Maddox perhaps wanted to discredit homeopathy, and it wouldn't help discrediting it if a paper never saw the light. Whereas if you could publish the paper and then show it was wrong, that would be good publicity. Essentially, as part of the refereeing process, they insisted that other laboratories try the experiment, and other laboratories tried it and found they got the results that highly diluted solutions were active. So it was a paper involving many laboratories. So Nature had their investigation by a rather curious crew, magician James Randi, somebody, and a science writer, and so on. People who didn't have any qualifications really to do the experiment went in, and they didn't get the experiment to work. They didn't realise that it's difficult quite often to get biological experiments to work. Things can readily interfere with them. They did actually get the experiment to work for a bit, but they said, oh, we'll do a control, and when with a control it doesn't work. But of course, correlation doesn't prove causality. But anyway, it was enough for Maddox to write an article saying that High Delusion was a delusion. Since it was an editorial article, it didn't have to be refereed, and a referee might have been pretty critical of it. Anyway, it got on, and then it became, once again, the accepted fact that there was no memory of water effect. Now, I'm not too clear how the evidence is, but from my point of view, being interested in how these controversial subjects get discredited, what interests me is the arguments used to show that memory of water is not possible. In other words, you cannot do something to water to produce a change that is remains for a long time. And one of these fallacious arguments is one which is quoted as no molecules, no effect. The idea behind this is that you've diluted water so highly that not a single molecule of whatever produced the activity in the first place is left. That's a fallacious argument because it is known that water forms into clusters, and these clusters can play the role of molecules. So in other words, your biologically active material may cause water molecules to cluster in particular ways, and these clusters may be what's producing the effect. Well, if you point this out to people, they then say, oh, but these things happen very quickly in water. You can measure the rate at which bonds form and dissolve, and that's very quick, so you can't get long-term effects. Well, that's another of these fallacious arguments. It fails to take into account the fact that you may have different time scales for different phenomena. In particular, a time scale for things at a molecular scale may not be the same as a time scale for bulk properties. This difference in time scale is clearly illustrated by the case of ferromagnetism, where we find that spin relaxation is quite fast. This is processes occurring at the atomic scale, whereas of course magnetism, the macroscopic effect, can persist for a very long time, for years at least. So this is these are two arguments which just don't hold up in under examination. But it happens in these controversial areas that any argument will do to discredit something. You don't look too closely at your own arguments to see if they hold up. Now, let me move on to a further controversial area. This is the connection between science and religion, or science and spirituality, however you want to call it. This is a matter of the ethics of science, what you have to believe to belong to the club, as it were. I can't think of this as being better stated by Sean Carroll in a Nature article on the Templeton Prize. What Carroll says is, the act of doing science means that you accept a purely material explanation of the universe, but no spiritual dimension is required. This is, to me, an extraordinary statement. In science, you can't rule anything out. And as science advances, it has to incorporate new phenomena as suggested by the evidence. Examples say dark matter and dark energy. Some phenomena was found via acceleration of the retreat of the galaxies, and the best explanation available was something called dark energy, which is still rather mysterious. So why on earth shouldn't it happen that some phenomena which people associate with spirituality should be such that the best explanation would be in terms of a spiritual dimension? Of course, you can't just say this is a spiritual dimension. If you want it to be scientific, you have to start formulating things more precisely. But you might put together a description of what spirituality is, which would involve testable hypotheses, like how certain experiences influence people. So it's perfectly conceivable, in my opinion, that science might, some future science might incorporate a spiritual aspect, just as it has incorporated quantum aspects and dark energy and so on in the past. And I should perhaps mention something we're working on. It's connected with the role of the observer in quantum mechanics. Some formulations of quantum mechanics involve putting in observation explicitly. We could do with a better explanation of the observer, but it's difficult to fit the observer into quantum mechanics. So what various people are trying to do is to put the observer in, and when we do that, we get some extension of quantum mechanics, and this might include the a spiritual dimension if we get a sufficiently complete view. So to sum up, I've talked about a whole set of phenomena or fields of research where the consensus science doesn't accept them. Certain ideas, it seems, have to be protected. You must not believe that in things like telepathy, or you're regarded as a bad scientist. You must not believe water can have a memory. So this is all, I think, it's not only bad for science because it limits the speed with which science can advance, but it may also be bad for mankind because scientific developments may lead to things which are good for society. And if we blot out certain phenomena, don't work on them, then this means these developments will no longer take place. So this pathology is something unfortunate, and I think the scientific community must address this and put their house in order. Thank you very much.